Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. President Vladimir Putin has declared a nationwide day of mourning Monday for the 92 people, including a popular military choir, on board the plane that crashed into the Black Sea Sunday. Putin has ordered a detailed investigation into the cause of the crash. He added that everything will be done to support the families of the victims. The Russian Defense Ministry says the plane crashed after taking off from the resort town of Sochi, bound for an airbase in Syria. This conductor of a local Moscow church called the crash a catastrophe for the world of music and song, because of the best of the Alexandrov Ensemble have been killed. Officials say debris from the aircraft and some bodies have been found just off the Russian coast. The main section of the plane has also been located. There is no indication so far what might have caused the crash. There was no distress signal sent from the cockpit. Pope Francis urged peace around the world as he made his traditional Christmas address Sunday. Speaking from St. Peter's Basilica, Francis spoke of those suffering through the Syrian war and urged the international community to find a negotiated solution to the conflict. Francis also spoke of the victims of terrorism following the truck attack in Berlin that recently left 12 dead and dozens injured. The pontiff said peace to those who have lost a person dear to them as a result of brutal acts of terrorism, and to those who have sown fear and death into the hearts of so many countries and cities. Pope Francis also urged Israelis and Palestinians to have the courage and determination to write a new page of history where hate and revenge give way to the will to build together a future of mutual understanding and harmony. This is VOA News. Christians in the northern Syrian city of Aleppo are celebrating a special Christmas Day service Sunday. They attended prayers for the first time since government forces took over full control of the city since rebels took over 4 years ago. Some worshippers expressed hope that peace will prevail in their country after years of bloodshed and hardship. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is voicing outrage at a UN Security Council vote calling for an end to further settlement activity in the occupied territories, saying he ordered his government to withhold $8 million to five UN institutions. Netanyahu called the U.S. abstention and the resolution itself, in his words, shameful, and he said his government would ignore its provisions.
For decades, American administrations and Israeli governments have disagreed about settlements, but we agreed that the Security Council was not the place to resolve this issue. We knew that going there would make negotiations harder and drive peace further away. And as I told John Kerry on Thursday, friends don't take friends to the Security Council.
Netanyahu also recalled Israel's ambassadors to New Zealand and Senegal, two of the resolution's four sponsors, and suspended Israeli aid programs to the West African nation. Parts of the Philippines have been evacuated after a powerful typhoon made landfall Sunday. The Weather Service in Manila says Typhoon Nakten, with gust of 235 kilometers per hour, struck Sunday evening on a remote island. Tens of thousands of residents have evacuated from coastal regions where forecasters are warning about possible huge waves and flooding. Nakten is expected to reach densely populated areas of the Philippines, including the capital, Manila, in the coming hours through Monday. A strong earthquake struck southern Chile on Sunday, prompting authorities to issue a tsunami warning. There were no immediate reports of damage or injuries. The U.S. Geological Survey said the tremor had a magnitude of 7.7 and was centered about 40 kilometers southwest of Chile's sparsely populated southern coast. It was the third earthquake this month of a 7.7 magnitude or higher along the quake-prone Pacific Rim, sometimes referred to as the Ring of Fire. And U.S. President-elect Donald Trump says he intends to dissolve his charitable foundation, which is currently under investigation in New York State in an effort to avoid any conflicts of interest before he takes office next month. Trump gave no timetable for the closing of the Donald J. Trump Foundation. I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Country had over 1,000 parliamentary candidates, out of which 108 were women. And out of 108, only 35 made it in the 7th parliament.
More Ghanaian female lawmakers in next year's parliament.
Critical deliberation should begin. The United States government should be talking with the Kenyan government and other EGON states about what is possible in terms of an emergency crisis diplomacy.
Top UN officials and experts warn that South Sudan may be heading towards genocide.
The first protocol was for the judge to explain that he had been unhappy with the original return of service and had directed the sheriff to reserve the notice of step down.
And a Zimbabwean High Court rules against First Lady Grace Mugabe. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The number of women in the Ghanaian parliament will increase from 29 to 35 in 2017. This after 35 women parliamentary candidates were declared winners in the December 7 general election. Catherine Afeku from the New Patriotic Party, or the NPP, is one of the winners. She told me more work needs to be done if Ghanaians want to see a sharp increase in female lawmakers.
First, we have to say a big hello and a Merry Christmas to your cherished listeners. It is very marginal. The whole country had over 1,000 parliamentary candidates, out of which 108 were women. And out of 108, only 35 made it to the 7th Parliament, which starts on the 7th of January. So, yes, it's a leap from 29 to 35, but it's still marginal because if you look at the population of Ghana, it's over 50% are women. And if we want representation of the true people of this country, then at least we should be inching towards 30% or 40, something nearer the UN goal. So we can't celebrate yet. It's only 35 women out of 26, 27 million people.
Let's look at your party, the New Patriotic Party. As a woman who has been a parliamentarian before, how are you going to champion the cause of women to recruit or possibly convince more women to participate in the primaries, if you may, of the party in the next parliament?
Well, in fairness to my party, we were the trendsetters. We started the affirmative action at the party level where female candidates were going to pay half of the filing fee. So that was a step. And we also pushed for women candidates to have at least allowed to be going unopposed. But, of course, that was shut down at the party level. But there was an attempt to ensure that more female candidates participated in the process. And for this to happen, I think we need to look at it holistically from the constitutional point of view, where you actually have an amendment. They've done it in Kenya, where it's in the constitution that not more than 2/3 of anyone going into the legislative assembly will be of one gender. So once you put it in the constitution, then the political parties have no option but to comply with the constitution of the land. That's the first one. Then the parties will do a good service to female potential leaders if we put it in the party's manifestos that all female parliamentarian or potential candidates will be given some incentives or certain seats that are safe will only be contested by only women. So it is not just nomination or tokenism, but at least 4 or 5 women will contest a seat. So you are sure that one will be a woman, you know. So those are some petty strategies that can be incorporated or inculcated in the party's strategies. But for me, the overall winning strategy is to amend the constitution.
Would we ever see in the Ghanaian parliament women in rival political parties, for that matter, working in unity to champion the causes of women anytime soon.
We have the Women Caucus. It's devoid of politics because we are not many. When I was in Parliament, we were only 19 in terms of 15 from MPP, 4 from the NDC. But we have the Women Caucus. It's all women in the Parliament, and we championed projects together as women in the House. The only problem we have is we are so few that you were to champion interstate secession bill, for example, which is still not passed. It's because you don't have the numbers. If you have 230 parliamentarians as of the time I was there, and only 19 are women, and you're trying to push a bill that has to do with interstate secession, the will of a predominantly male society, naturally, you will not get the support. You know, when you're looking at the numbers, it is not favorable. Now we are 275 parliamentarians, and we're only 35. So if you come up with a bill that says you should divvy up your properties with your wife, 35 women cannot, you know, overshadow 240-something men. So it's always been the numbers.
Catherine Afeku is from the Ghanaian New Patriotic Party, or the NPP. She spoke with me from the capital, Accra. Top UN officials and experts have warned that South Sudan may be heading towards genocide. This, if immediate and concerted efforts are not put in place to pressure rival leaders to stop fighting. Officials and leading human rights defenders recently attended a forum at the Rift Valley Institute, a non-profit think tank that operates in conflict-prone African countries. They said instability in South Sudan is threatening the region. For VOA, Ruben Chiama has more from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Speaking at the forum was John Prendergast, a renowned human rights activist and the founder of the Enough Project, an initiative to end genocide and crimes against humanity. He urged the new U.S. administration and the international community to send a top-level diplomat to push for renewed peace talks.
Critical deliberation should begin. The United States government should be talking with the Kenyan government and other IGAD states about what is possible in terms of an emergency crisis diplomacy, and that needs to be initiated immediately. We suggested back in Washington for an American audience that President Obama should name a very senior person who has bipartisan support, so that there's Republican and Democrats buy-in, who potentially could bridge the gap after January to the next administration.
Renewed fighting broke out in December 2013, just 2.5 years after the country gained independence from neighboring Sudan. The violence erupted when forces loyal to President Salva Kiir started battling those loyal to Riek Machar, his former vice president. Miss Priscilla Nyagoa Tut, a South Sudanese human rights campaigner with the Amnesty International, says negotiations aimed at brokering a peace deal have crumbled.
We might have a strong Secretary General, but if the Security Council states continue to politic the way they are around South Sudan, then there will be no progress. For instance, around the arms embargo vote, it was really African countries such as Angola and Senegal that were sitting on the fence and failing to, you know, give the US the votes it needed to pass this very critical resolution on an arms embargo. So not only directing messages at the Secretary General, but the 15-member Security Council.
Prendergast is a key expert who has focused on peace efforts in Africa for more than 30 years. He says a peace deal signed in August 2015, mediated by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, has not stopped the fighting, which has killed tens of thousands of people and forced 3.1 million to flee their homes.
We need a much higher level effort. And there are different pieces. The national dialogue, or a national dialogue, a credible national dialogue, is something that probably has to happen much later. Certainly the current idea of a dialogue that is controlled by the head of state, that makes no commitment about the results of that dialogue, haven't actually any impact on the situation on the ground, no commitment to implement those. We've seen this movie before, and it doesn't end well. So I would hope that the international community would not, including our new government, a new administration in Washington, wouldn't fall for this one.
The Nairobi meeting came shortly after the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon appointed New Zealand lawmaker David Shearer as head of the UN peacekeeping mission in South Sudan. Philip Winter, co-founder of the Rift Valley Institute, which organized the debate, praised the new appointment.
He's not a stranger to the region. He was my colleague when I was a field director for Save the Children in South Sudan during Operation Lifeline Sudan. David was the SCF field director for Somalia. He went on then to a career at a fairly senior level in the UN. He came to South Sudan as one of the two evaluators of the work that my team was doing there during Operation Lifeline Sudan.
The Institute operates in South Sudan, including other conflict-prone countries in sub-Saharan Africa, such as Somalia, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. According to Peter Beer Ajak, a South Sudanese human rights activist, the UN peacekeeping mission in South Sudan has struggled over the years to contain the crisis and complained about Kenya's recent withdrawal from the peace process.
Personally, I was confused actually by Kenya's reaction. I always had this assumption of Kenya as a very rational state, a state that is very advanced in terms of calculating its vital national interests, a country that is very aggressive in pursuing its vital national interests.
In spite of the 2015 agreement, fighting has continued to devastate South Sudan, pushing the already struggling young country to the edge of famine, stalling development, and claiming lives. However, South Sudanese officials say the description of possible genocide is a bit far exaggerated and does not reflect the reality on the ground. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
A former graphic designer in South Africa has made a name for himself internationally for the knives he forges in Johannesburg. Andre van Straten's clients around the world include professional hunters, fishermen, and survivalists. His knives are respected for their clean, flowing lines, elegant curves, and interesting shapes. Experts also praise them for being razor sharp, extremely tough, and highly corrosion resistant. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports in the second part of the series about some of South Africa's master crafters.
Andre van Straten sorts through raw steel in his workshop. He says his relationship with knives started when he was a toddler.
When I was a kid, I used to like climb up onto the table, pull a chair out, get into the knife drawer, and pull knives out and play with them and, you know, chuck them on the floor and stuff. I've always been fascinated by knives. I've just always had a connection to them.
Van Straten, in his early 40s, remembers the first knife he bought when he was 12. He describes it as a cheapie from a pawn shop.
An old Bowie knife, a Chinese piece of junk. I've still got it. It's in pieces, it's scratched, it's blunt, but I've still got what's left of it.
He made his first knife when he was 15, using his dad's tools and scrap steel. It was a dagger he copied from the cover of a fantasy novel. Decades of amateur knife making followed. Then, a few years ago, van Straten turned professional under the tutelage of an expert bladesmith. He buys high-quality stainless steel and grinds it into the various styles of knives he makes, from those used by hunters to skin animals, to the style that's his passion, tactical knives with serrated blades, like those used by Army Special Forces.
Like the kind of knife you could use in a wilderness situation or a survival situation, but also as a defensive tool and as a weapon.
Van Straten heat treats his knives in an electric furnace. Then he oils them and tempers the blades in an oven at 360 degrees Fahrenheit for 2 hours to make the steel ultra hard. He polishes the knives with a machine to a chrome finish.
And then for handle materials, natural wood, bone, horn, and then G10, which is layers of fabric impregnated with resin.
Van Straten says people think it's easy to make a knife. After all, it's just a handle and a blade. But he considers it to be an intricate art, and it's that complexity that excites him.
Designing a knife is very weird. It's an art of millimeters. You move a line a millimeter this way, a millimeter that way, changes the shape, changes the feel of the knife. And there are millions and millions and millions of configurations, and everyone is different. And it's just, you know, you just go, okay, well, what can I make next?
Van Straten sells these knives for an average of about $250. Many are attractive, the silver of the blades contrasting, for example, with an African hardwood handle that's almost purple in color. But he insists knives can't just be pretty ornaments.
I choose function over form, but again, you don't want a useful knife that's just butt ugly. That's also no good.
Van Straten holds a knife with a broad, jagged blade and a handle decorated with twisted green and black patterns. He says a friend and his son inspired him to make it.
They were carjacked, and the son was quite traumatized, and he had a thing for knives, and he only felt safe when he had a knife. So for his 13th birthday, I designed this knife, and I made it for him, and his name was Callum. So Callum Tactical Knife, so I called it the Caltac.
Security experts have taught Van Straten how to defend himself using a knife, but he says he never wants to use those skills.
If a guy pulls a knife and wants to fight me, I'm just going to run in the opposite direction. I'm not going to stand and trade blows, because people think, oh, you'll take a cut on your forearm. That thing will cut your arm. You'll never use it again. You know what I mean? You'll
see what work. As he prepares his workshop, Van Straten says he also crafts leather knife sheaths. But it's not his favorite part of his craft.
I don't like working with sharpened knives when I'm working with leather, because I'm quite clumsy and I can cut myself.
Man, that doesn't inspire confidence, man. You're a knife maker and you're telling me you're clumsy.
I am clumsy, but so far I've still got all my fingers. I do tend to cut them every now and then, but I haven't had any serious injuries so far, touch wood.
It's Van Straten's knives that are serious. Serious works of art, and recognized as such by customers all over the world. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
A Zimbabwean High Court has ordered First Lady Grace Mugabe to remove her representatives from three houses she took over belonging to a Lebanese national. He failed to refund $1.35 million that she paid for a diamond ring. In a ruling, Justice Clement Fury said Mrs. Mugabe should also ensure that all workers who lost their jobs at the three properties owned by the diamond seller, Jamal Ahmed, are reinstated. Ahmed is represented by Beatrice Ntetwa. She told VOA reporter Blessing Zulu that the judge expressed disappointment over the way the case was handled, as armed guards refused to accept summons sent to Mrs. Mugabe.
The case was set down for 10 o'clock in the morning. We went at 10 o'clock. There was no appearance from the respondent. And so we started hearing the matter. The first port of call was for the judge to explain that he had been unhappy with the original return of service and had directed the sheriff to reserve the notice of set down and to clearly state if he fails to serve why. And the sheriff had again attempted service at Blue Roof, and he failed to serve the notice of set down because none of the security personnel at the premises were willing to accept service, and none of them were willing to identify themselves. And, you know, our rules say that if that happens, you then affix the document to the door or the gate. And he had failed to do that because of resistance from an armed soldier who barred him from further action. While we're in the middle of that hearing, the judge was called by the judge president.
Did the case resume after that?
He came back and said, due to something urgent that had cropped up, he would hear the matter in the afternoon. In the afternoon at 2:30, there were two lawyers, Mr. Manasseh and Mr. Paspano, just from Manasseh, who came to apply for a postponement. After long, long arguments, the judge declined to postpone the matter and granted us the relief, which basically is that they should vacate the three properties forthwith.
What happens if the state agents that are forcibly occupying these houses do not comply?
And if they are still there, in 24 hours, the sheriff should go and evict them, and that they should restore all the workers' property that they have removed.
Beatrice Ntetwa is a Zimbabwean lawyer. She spoke with VOA reporter Blessing Zulu. December 21st marked the winter solstice. It's the moment in the astronomical calendar when the sun has reached its farthest point from the Earth at the equator and the amount of daylight in the northern hemisphere finally begins to increase. For ancient peoples, living through this changing length of day and night must have been frightening, and it was cause for joy and celebration when the light seemed to be reborn. As VOA's Adam Phillips reports, the winter solstice carries sacred significance for many modern folks as well.
I've been searching through the darkness, return to me, beloved, for the night's gone on too long, return to me, my love.
California musician Ann Hill sings a song addressed to the sun, whose light is dimmed during the days leading to the winter solstice.
Return to me, my love.
Ann Hill also co-wrote Circle Round, Raising Children in Goddess Traditions, a book of stories and hands-on activities for families who wish to put nature and its cycles at the center of their spiritual life. She reads an excerpt.
This is the time of Yule, the ancient name for the winter solstice, the longest night and the shortest day of the year, where the swirling snow and the icy mist, the cold touches our bones. There's no warmth left in the ground. The days are short now, and night seems to go on forever. Throughout human history, and in every corner of the globe, people have celebrated the moment of winter solstice, when the sun starts its slow ascent towards the summer.
Many seasonal religious holidays echo that experience today, even if they do not make any direct reference to the sun or to nature. Christmas celebrates the birth of Jesus, who is called the light of the world. The 8-day Jewish festival of Hanukkah celebrates the miracle of light's rebirth and growth.
You have the urge in these long, cold, dark nights to have candles burning, which are warm and which give us light.
That's Diane Baker, one of Ann Hill's two co-authors for Circle Round. Like Ms. Hill, Ms. Baker's spirituality is tied directly to nature, which she often personifies by female divinities like Mother Earth and Grandmother Moon, and by traditionally male symbols like the sun and sky. She describes one winter solstice ritual she does with her children to make the concept of light emerging from darkness real to them.
In my home, we decorate the house with cutouts of the sun, which are black paper on one side and bright yellow paper on the other side, and we cover them with glue and we slather them with glitter and we hang them on the children's doors. When we go to sleep on solstice night, the black sides are facing out. Before dawn, we get up and we go to the highest place. We greet the sun and we dance and we eat the cookies we've baked the night before. And when we come back, we run into the house and we turn the suns over to their yellow glitter sides.
But the winter solstice is not just for children. It inspires deep-seated anxieties and truth that are the stuff of poetry, theater, and myth. Here's Starhawk, the third co-author of Circle Round, reads a prose poem based on a Celtic agrarian tradition. In it, the sun is personified as a dark, aged king, reborn as a child to the mother goddess.
This is the night of solstice, the longest night of the year. Now darkness triumphs and yet gives way and changes into light. The breath of nature is suspended. All waits while within the cauldron, the dark king is transformed into the infant light. We watch for the coming of dawn, when the great mother again gives birth to the child son who is bringer of hope and the promise of summer. We turn the wheel to bring the light. We call the sun from the womb of night.
Goddess-based spirituality celebrates the many correspondences between the cycles of nature and the rhythms of human life. Understanding and making use of those principles is the source of both magic and power, in the view of many on that path, Diana Jordan among them.
And if you do a certain kind of ritual at the point of longest darkness that allows you to somehow visualize something in your life that you want to increase, like maybe courage or truth.
Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's look at highlights in athletics in 2016. Nine-time Olympic champion Usain Bolt won the IAAF Male Athlete of the Year award for a record sixth time. Ethiopia's Almaz Ayan, who broke the 10,000-meter world record by over 14 seconds in winning Olympic gold in Rio this summer, won the female award. Bolt sealed the triple-triple in Rio, winning his third Olympic title in each of the 100 meters, 200 meters, and 4x100 meters. Bolt will retire next year following the 2017 World Athletics Championships in London. Ayana, meanwhile, broke a record set 23 years earlier when she clocked 29 minutes, 17.45 seconds in Rio. The 25-year-old also won 5,000 meters bronze and won the diamond race. Canada's Andre Degrassi, the 22-year-old who won 200 meters silver and 100 meters bronze in Rio, was named Male Rising Star. Harry Mara won the IAAF Coaching Achievement Award after guiding Ashton Eaton to a second Olympic decathlon gold and Brianne Thiessen-Eaton to heptathlon bronze. Meanwhile, Kipchong and Samsung were named as the best male and female winners of the Ames Best Marathon Runner Award and were recognized at the 4th annual Ames Best Marathon Runner Awards dinner reception in Athens, Greece on November 11th. The Nandi-born runners, Eliud Kipchoge and Jemima Sumgong, won London Marathon this year, and without competing in any major races, they prepared for the Olympic Marathon and they went ahead to win the Olympic Marathon titles in Rio, Brazil. The 31-year-olds won London Marathon in April, where Kipchoge set new course record of 2 hours, 3 minutes and 5 seconds, while Sumgong won in 2 hours, 22 minutes and 58 seconds. Kipchoge became the second Kenyan to win Olympic Marathon title after the late Samuel Wanjiri won the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games in China. And Sumgong won the first ever women's marathon at the Olympic Games. Our energetic Andy Edwards was in Athens at the Ames Award ceremony and caught up with Jemima Sumgong.
It's been a great year for the women's Olympic champion, Jemima Sumgong of Kenya. Of course, I just said Olympic champion. Started off pretty well competitively, winning the London Marathon title in April. Then came a wonderful experience for her, Olympic gold in Rio. And now, to kind of crown it off, is the Ames Best Marathon Runner of the Year award, in the female category, of course, here in Athens. So, Jemima, I just wonder, when you were starting out on your running career, did you anticipate such success?
You know, with me, I didn't expect anything like for today because, you know, back in Kenya, we have many more athletes who are more talented than me. So with me, I didn't think that I would be one day, one time to be the best marathoners in female side of Ames. But with God's grace, he really made me to be here.
So when you were starting out and perhaps looking around at other girls and young women running, did you think you had special talent? Did you think there were others better than you? Did you think there are others better than you when you were starting out to run?
Oh, yeah, I knew. There are more people who are more better than me. We have some sisters back in Kenya. We have some in Ethiopia. We have also some in Greece. Why not Athens? So we have different ladies or girls who can run faster even than me. It's but only when they train hard.
Looking at your overall results, you've won big races like London. You've had very good times. Okay, you haven't broken 220 yet, but I just think when you come to a championship race, especially the Olympics above all, then it's not about pacemakers, it's about coping with all sorts of conditions. Does that suit you? Are you best suited to championship races? Are you best suited to those championship races, you know, when, like you did well in the World Championships, you were fourth, is that good for you?
That one, I cannot say that I am used to world championship races because I've never been to Olympic. That was my first time to be in Olympic. It was my first time last year to be in Beijing world championships. So that can never be I'm used to. But I'm used to huge or big marathons like London, Chicago, New York. So also Olympics and world championships are the major marathons also. So it's like I have a little bit experience than ever. Yeah, that's why I won the championships.
What now? You're Olympic champion. You did well in the World Championships 2 years ago. Do you still have the same hunger? I mean, next year we have the World Championships again. Are you as hungry as an athlete?
With me, my focus is first on after my marathon in April. My country will decide who will go to World Championships and who will qualify to go for World Championships and who will stay. So with me, I don't know if I will qualify or I will not qualify. If in case I will qualify, I'm going to try my level best to win gold in London in World Championships.
Well, Jemima Sumgong, the AIM's best marathon runner of the year and, of course, above all, the Olympic champion in the women's marathon. Congratulations. Thank you, Jemima.
Thank you very much, sir. See you.
Thanks, Andy. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Oh, yes. Girl, I'm drowning in your love. Yeah. So, baby, take it all. I know it's you, no turning back. Girl, I said it all. I don't care what people say about you. Don't care if they must spoil you from you. Because a good old lullaby, kuwewa. I told you before that I wanna go far with you. Doubt in a fit mess up too. Hasa mi mabu, show my duro. Belu mi manoko. Oh, no go joro manoko. And if I want a baby from you, give me one. No fear, fear. Baby, oh baby, oh girl, I just want you to know. Up another woman, no how. Feeling I'm feeling for you, baby, is awakening my soul. I will love you till nobody else see what they won't do for you. Why? Yeah, you no go regret. Nothing go make me forget. Only you I no go to share. Cause a good old lullaby, kuwewa. I told you before that I wanna go far with you. Doubts in a fit mess up too. Hasa mi mabu, show na kuwabelu mi manoko. Bo unobo joro manoko. Yeah, boda boda che, go nowhere. And if I want a baby from you, give me one, no fear, fear. Baby, oh baby, oh girl, I just want you to know. Body ni ni dai.
Yeah, digging up me, talking what happened now. As I see your sexy face and your baby belly, tell I have to change my ways, I tell you, yeah. Me, myself, I pray for my baby. Give up, I'm a girl, you carry belly for me, oh. Me, myself, I pray for my baby. Give up, me, oh, you look fair, no more wrong. But then, your father is violent. Oh, let me get low. Jumbo, 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 we'll be fine, daddy, oh. Your mother is black, but he's a big character. Jumbo, 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 I beg no vex for me, oh. Your father is violent. Oh, let me get low. Jumbo, 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 we'll be fine, mommy, oh. Your mother is black, but he's a big character. Jumbo, 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 I don't get so no more. I'm a car, you know, oh, oh. Come on, you're a ballet, yo. If your papa no want us to marry, yo, I'm a lawyer, you know. No, girl, I'm down for you, don't forget. The love me, I get it for you, I'm a no go compare. Oh, leave myself, for my day, yeah, I give up. Baby broke as long as you love me, girl, I dare, yeah. Leave myself, for my day, yeah, pray for my day, yeah. Oh, no, no, fair, no more wrong. But then, your father is violent. Oh, let me get low. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. Hello, you define daddy, oh. Your mother is black, but she's a big character. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. I bet no better. Your father is violent. Oh, let me get low. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. We'll be fine, mommy, oh. Your mother is black, but she's a big character. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. I don't get so no more.
Show me what sexy my That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now
Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Professional diplomats and academics engaged in conflict resolutions are fond of asserting that preventive diplomacy is preferable to active negotiations to resolve conflict. Sadly, the assertion of preventive diplomacy is merely assertion. Seldom are they pursued. A good case is that of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC. For months, it has become very clear that President Kabila and his supporters have been trying to play tricks on the people of the DRC. It was also evident that this course of action will lead to bloodshed. Over the last week, we have seen bloodshed in the DRC because the president has failed to leave office when his term of office ended on the 19th of December. Now, negotiations are going on under the auspices of the Catholic Church. It has proven difficult to reach a solution, and the prospect is that if there is goodwill all around, there might be a resolution this coming week. But we should be very clear what the transitional arrangement should be. It is very suspicious that the president has been reluctant to assert that he would not run for a third term. If the argument that is being made by supporters is that he would only want to continue because there was no election, why is he afraid to assert that he would not run for a third term? The opposition in the DRC, which also include political parties and civil society groups, are very suspicious of the intention of this president. It is therefore necessary to have the terms of a secure transitional arrangement. One, any transitional arrangement must make it very clear that this arrangement is not tied to the constitutional term of office of the incumbent. We have had in the past, like in Liberia, transitional arrangements. And under those terms, anyone heading a transitional arrangement is not permitted to run for the office of president following the transitional arrangement. This would eliminate immediately any intention of the president to continue for a third term. The second point in such a transitional arrangement must be that there should be full financing of the Electoral Commission so that all arrangements should be completed before the end of 2017 so that there is no need to go as far as April 2018. And the third point that is required in this transitional arrangement should be that everyone, the opposition, the president, and his supporters will abide by the agreement. And this should be endorsed, preferably by the African Union and, if necessary, by the United Nations Security Council. Already, the wider international community has expressed concern for the violence that is now occurring in the DRC. But this should also be a lesson that the international community should be watchful when incumbent presidents try to find ways and means to continue in office beyond the two terms inscribed in the Constitution. An appeal must be made to the political parties of the DRC to ensure that the constitutional arrangement preserves the life and property of all the people of the DRC. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Odette Frazier, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a person with too much ambition cannot sleep in peace. I'm your host, Peter Clotley in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Reflecting American ideals and institutions.
In a popular American short story, a young couple, poor but very much in love, frets over what to give each other for Christmas. To buy her husband Jim a chain for his proudest possession, a gold pocket watch, Della sells her proudest possession, her long brown hair, to be made into a wig. Jim finds Della a fine pair of hair combs, but he can pay for them only by trading away his watch. When they exchange gifts and realize what they've done, their now useless presents are all the more precious because of the love and sacrifice they represent. The holiday of Christmas, which millions of Americans and others around the world celebrate today, has inspired many such tales. Some deal with the lessons of generosity and hope, others with the value of friendship, family, and faith. Oddly, one of the most famous, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, is essentially a ghost story. What they have in common is a spirit of redemption and rejoicing that has long touched the human heart. Tradition is as much a part of the holiday as is its spirit. As in much of the world, millions of Americans will exchange gifts, worship together in their various ways, then gather perhaps with family and friends to complete the celebration over dinner. Many will volunteer to help the homeless, hungry, and others in need. These sentiments transcend nationality, however, and even religion. As the world gets smaller, the Christmas spirit is seen in many places, from Europe to Africa and even Asia. In Japan, Christmas is known more as a time to spread happiness rather than as a religious celebration. Presents and cards are exchanged, and parties are often held for children, with games and dancing. In Madagascar, an island nation off the east coast of Africa, it's summer at Christmas time, but even though it's hot, many homes are decorated in the spirit of the season with holly and imitation snow, even though none of them exist there. The message of peace on earth and goodwill toward men is universal, and one that Americans wish to share at this time of year with all citizens of the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.